Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, Palestinian prisoners call for the release of an Israeli taxi driver, possibly kidnapped by militants. Is it a gesture that could help the region's fragile peace?
And aid workers, the latest targets for violence in Iraq.
What's in a word? When it's 16 words and they're delivered by the President of the United States, there's a lot at stake.
Credibility, Robin, is the major component of presidential leadership. And so he's in danger of losing the most important part of his presidency.
Also, we say goodbye to Kumpai Segundo, lead singer of the Buena Vista Social Club.
These stories and the two tenors coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Tropical storm Claudette is nearing hurricane strength as it churns its way toward the Gulf Coast of Texas. Hurricane warnings have been posted along a 200-mile stretch of coastline. Judge Gilberto Hinojoso in Cameron County, Texas, says evacuation of that area would take some time.
Full relocation of those people that generally leave from the coastal communities takes about 7 hours to get them into the adjacent county. And so with about 3 hours lead time, you're looking at about a total of 10 hours.
Claudette is now less than 300 miles east-southeast of Corpus Christi. In the latest ambush in Iraq, a U.S. Army convoy traveling in Baghdad was attacked with rocket-propelled grenades. The U.S. military says one soldier was killed and six others were wounded. NPR's Eric Westerveld has more from Baghdad.
American officials had warned of a possible increase in attacks on U.S. forces this week, which sees a series of holidays celebrated under Saddam Hussein, including dates marking the political rise of the dictator and his Ba'ath Party in the late 1960s. Today's deadly attack comes as the newly created 25-member Iraqi Governing Council met for its first full day. The U.S.-backed group aims to represent the diverse ethnic, religious, and tribal factions in the country. The council includes 13 Shiites, a religious majority here, long oppressed under Saddam Hussein. Iraqis are mixed on the council. Some say it lacks legitimacy and authority. Others, however, call it a positive first step toward self-rule. Eric Westerveld, NPR News, Baghdad.
The council members have chosen some working committees today, but they've held off selecting a new leader. The council has come in for some criticism also by the head of the Arab League, who says the panel would have more credibility if its members had been elected by Iraqis rather than hand-picked by U.S. officials. Rescue workers in China have nearly given up hope of finding more than 50 people who've been missing since a landslide hit the western part of that country. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Beijing.
More than 500 people have been killed in floods, landslides, and other disasters triggered by heavy rains this year in China. A spokeswoman in western Sichuan province said today that chances of finding the missing people alive were very slim. Meanwhile, more than 1.6 million people have been evacuated from low-lying areas around the swollen Huai River in the eastern provinces of Anhui and Jiangsu. The river has in some places reached 10 inches above previous record high levels. The Red Cross says that dikes along the river have begun to give way and that food, drinking water and medicine are all in short supply. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Beijing.
On Wall Street, stock prices have been in positive territory since the opening bell today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently up 146 points at 9,266 in moderate trading. And the Nasdaq is up 36 points at 1770. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Wall Street has opened the new trading week with a rally. Gaining issues lead losers on the big board by a nearly 3-to-1 margin so far today. Analysts cite a number of factors, including Boise Cascade's agreement to buy the OfficeMax chain and a ratings upgrade on Intel by Merrill Lynch. Also, financial giant Citigroup says healthy gains in its consumer business sector helped boost second quarter profits by 5%. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC has more.
The rising earnings come as Citigroup chairman Sanford Weill tries to expand the company's consumer base, while at the same time maintaining its position as the top global stock and bond underwriter. The jump in Citigroup consumer lending income included a 63% rise in retail banking income to just over $1 billion. Profit from credit cards rose 6% to $768 million. Citigroup said overall profit rose to $4.3 billion, or 83 cents a share, from $4.08 billion, or 78 cents a share last year. Some industry analysts have said they expect Citigroup to continue acquiring new banking properties in North America. Last year, the company bought Golden State Bank Corp, one of the nation's largest savings and loans. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan.
Gasoline prices have edged up again over the past 3 weeks, up 1 cent a gallon on average nationwide to $1.55. Prices at the pump have been rising steadily since June. Internet portal Yahoo is buying Overture Services in a $1.6 billion deal. Overture, which used to be known as GoTo.com, pioneered pay-for-placement search engines, which advertisers bid for the right to have their links displayed under specific search terms. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
His taxi found with the engine still running on the West Bank last Friday. 61-year-old Elihu Gurel is feared kidnapped by Palestinian militants. But in an indication of the nuances now at play in the Mideast peace process, a group of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails has called for the taxi driver's safe return. Israel has released 300 Palestinians in recent weeks, and the prisoners may fear that no one else will be freed if the driver is killed. The prisoners' gesture, with a note of reconciliation in it, is tempered by new threats from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who say they may end their present ceasefire if the Palestinian Authority attempts to disarm them, as Israel has demanded. And Sunday, another indication of the deep divides among many Palestinians, a mob attacked a prominent Palestinian pollster as he prepared to announce his finding that a vast majority of Palestinians now would be willing to abandon their right of return, the right to reclaim their land, the right to reclaim land their families once lived on in Israel, so long as they're compensated. Well, to examine all this, after weeks of relative quiet between Israelis and Palestinians, we're joined now from Jerusalem by New York Times correspondent James Bennett. And James, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Well, James, Palestinians radical enough to have been thrown in jail by Israel, now calling for the safety of an Israeli taxi driver. What's going on here? Is this just self-interest they want out of jail or something more?
Well, I think there is clearly an element of self-interest here. But that's not a bad thing. What may move this peace process forward is self-interest on both sides, I think, rather than any real romantic visions of great sacrifice or concession to push it ahead. These prisoners want out, and they sense the possibility that Israel was beginning to consider releasing more of them. And they saw this as basically a goodwill gesture that might be well received by the Israelis. I should add that the Palestinian security forces are also participating in this hunt for the taxi driver. They have been for the last couple of days. It's a very mysterious case. No one has claimed responsibility for kidnapping this man. We still don't know what group is holding him, or indeed what condition he may be in.
Uh-huh. Let's turn then to the incident involving a man named Halil Shikaki, who's perhaps the most prominent Palestinian pollster. I might first mention that we were supposed to speak to Mr. Shikaki this morning, but he had to leave his office because of what he said was a crackdown in Ramallah on the West Bank where he was. Would that crackdown have something to do with the taxi driver, do you think?
It appears to have something to do with the taxi driver. Israel announced a curfew in Ramallah. There hasn't been one there in some time.
Now, Mr.
Yeah, they seem to be searching for this guy there.
Right. Now, Mr. Shikaki was about to announce the findings of his new poll. What were those findings, James?
It's an unusual poll in that it's quite comprehensive. His researcher spoke to 4,500 refugee families in the West Bank and Gaza, and also in Lebanon and in Jordan. And what he found is that overwhelmingly 95% of these refugees and their descendants insist on Israel recognizing their so-called right of return. That is, their claim that they have a right to return to homes that were abandoned, from which they fled or were driven during the Arab-Israeli War in 1948. Those homes are now inside Israel.
Right.
While they insist on claiming it, he found on questioning them further a degree of pragmatism among these refugees. They want the right, but they don't necessarily want to exercise it if they have other options. For example, the right to move into a new Palestinian state with compensation for the property they lost, or the opportunity to move to the United States or Canada, perhaps receive citizenship there and also compensation. These options, by the way, were part of the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians 2 years ago, although they were never formally agreed upon.
So just briefly, what happened to Mr. Shikaki when he tried to make this announcement?
Well, he was attempting yesterday to present these results in Arabic, actually, to the Arabic language press, and a mob of about 100 people stormed into the office, destroyed some of the furniture, shoved the staff around. He retreated to a rear room. They broke through the window onto a balcony, broke through his window and attacked him, roughed him up. Others in the mob actually restrained some who might have done more violence to him. It was a very organized mob, though, that arrived with its own press release in Arabic and English, basically challenging his results while also misinterpreting them to say that what he claimed to have found was that Palestinians, in fact, wanted to give up this right of return in overwhelming numbers. It's a more nuanced finding than that.
Huh.
He saw it very much as a cynical manipulation of what really is one of the most explosive issues among Palestinians, this claim of a right of return, and, if you will, a bank shot directed at the new Palestinian Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas, who many Palestinians fear is taking too soft a line toward Israel in negotiations over this new peace plan.
Yeah, well, speaking of the new Prime Minister, Mahmoud Abbas, of course, at the moment, he's not on speaking terms with Yasser Arafat. Could Yasser Arafat have anything to do with this attack on the pollster?
We don't know, but the group did march from Dr. Shikaki's office, the two or three blocks, to Yasser Arafat's compound, where he received them yesterday.
I see.
Again, it's not clear that he knew what they had been up to, but he's always very, very careful to assert that the right of return is an ironclad right from which he would never retreat.
James, James, just very briefly, I'm sorry, we're running out of time a bit here, but just very briefly, how seriously to take these threats by Hamas and Islamic Jihad to end their temporary ceasefire if Mahmoud Abbas, the prime minister, tries to disarm them?
This has always been their position, that if there's any effort to arrest them or take away their arms, they'll resume their attacks. The bind that Mahmoud Abbas is in is that those are exactly the steps that Israel says he must take before they'll allow the peace process to go forward.
James Bennett of The New York Times, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
James Bennett is Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times.
In Iraq, American troops are increasingly in the line of fire, but aid workers from around the world are also fast becoming a target. The Office of the World Food Program, the United Nations Food Agency, says security incidents are affecting its food operations in Iraq. Storage facilities have been looted, truck convoys are attacked, and the WFP office hit by a grenade. Antonia Paradilla is the public information officer for the World Food Program in Baghdad. She joins us now on the line from Baghdad.
Hello from Baghdad.
Tell us about the incidents that are, you know, hampering your ability to deliver aid.
We are seeing more attacks against trucks that are delivering food into Iraq and also to the warehouses, keeping our food these warehouses belong to the Iraqi Ministry of Trade.
Well, who is supposed to protect the WFP and the food and the workers?
The Coalition Provisional Authority and the U.S. and British troops have the responsibility to protect not only these food aid operations, but to improve the overall security. When we have an incident, we raise it with them and they are responsive. But it is also true that with so many things going on and practically no law and order, being in this country, it's an uphill struggle.
Well, I would say so. And the American troops are having a hard time protecting themselves. There have been several U.S. soldiers killed. But do you feel that you have enough protection from U.S. troops?
They have been very responsive. They were there since the end of the war, and then they trained local Iraqis to guard these facilities, and they gave them weapons. What has happened in some cases is that these people don't feel confident enough to prepare the attacks of looters. At the level of, for example, truck transport, we brought about 24,000 trucks from the neighboring countries in the month of June. It is impossible to give an escort to each of these transports.
Antonia, do you get the feeling that those who are attacking all of those trucks or the facilities are just bandits, or is it an effort to undermine the new Iraq?
We feel it's mostly criminal elements that take advantage of this state of lack of law and order. We don't think it's anything targeted. Besides, the trucks are commercial trucks from the neighboring countries. Most of the time, they don't have any markings.
So you feel that it's just a criminal element and banditry. Well, there's concern here in the U.S. at the Pentagon that there's going to be a surge in assaults on American troops because of upcoming Iraqi holidays connected to Saddam Hussein. Are you also worried about a surge in assaults?
Today is a national holiday, and there have been a couple of car bombs incidents, but we haven't really seen anything affecting our operations, and I mean, we're happy to see that. There is another bank holiday, which is next Thursday. It has recently been canceled by the newly form political council here in Iraq, but it is the day where the Ba'ath Party was celebrating its access to power. We are all very concerned about security, and we are monitoring the situation here, seeing if there is any increase in security incidents related to this date. But I have to say also that, I mean, having been out and about talking to Iraqis, overall people are very happy to see their country moving forward. And they are really looking forward to seeing the country blooming, new economic opportunities, and new opportunities for Iraq to become a sort of better nation for everybody.
But you do have, as you said, this other element. Antonia, thank you.
Thank you.
Antonia Paradilla is the Public Information Officer for the World Food Program in Iraq. She spoke to us from Baghdad.
And this note, Compay Segundo, the lead singer of the Buena Vista Social Club, has died.
En el barrio La Cachimba se ha formado la corredera. Allá fueron los bomberos con sus...
He was born in eastern Cuba in 1907. Máximo Francisco Repilado Muñoz was raised in the city of Santiago, which was then the fast-beating heart of Cuba's musical culture. Segundo began playing clarinet in Santiago's municipal band when he was just 14. He later was known mostly as a singer. His nickname, Compay Segundo, came from his group, Los Compadres, in which he was the second, Segundo, voice. He came of age when Cuban music was first marrying the yearnings of Spanish lyricism to the irresistible pulse of African rhythm to conjure the music known as son. Segundo was popular throughout the 1950s and then the Cuban Revolution, though he always held on to his day job rolling Coronas in a local cigar factory. By the 1980s, though, he'd been largely forgotten, certainly outside of Cuba, so much so that even many Cuban music lovers thought he had died. That changed when Segundo was already deep into his 70s. A Spanish tourist heard him play and brought him to Europe. International acclaim would follow eventually when Ry Cooder recorded the Buena Vista Social Club
followed by the movie of the same name. Compay Segundo died yesterday of kidney failure, 2 days after attending a tribute concert in his honor. He was 95 years old.
Sintiendo la pulsante herida de tu cruel desprecio. No sabes que mi amor es puro como el sol, amor gigante. Y aunque yo muera mujer, he de adorarte.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Those 16 words spoken by George Bush in his State of the Union address helped launch a war and have now launched a war of words. Last week, CIA Director George Tenet fell on his sword, saying he should have had the words removed because his agency found no proof of Hussein seeking uranium from Africa. Yesterday, Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice fell all over themselves with the new message that the words probably shouldn't have been used, but they're true. End of story, concluded Rumsfeld on ABC's This Week. Really? Well, joining us are members of our D.C. roundtable. David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, David.
Hello.
And we want to welcome back Sarah Fritz, Washington Bureau Chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida, who's returning to us after a long, annoying illness. Sarah, it's so good to talk to you again.
Nice to be back.
Well, the New York Times this morning called this a legalistic defense of the phrasing. David, your thoughts?
Well, all I can say is that many, many years ago in Washington, I learned the lesson that in Washington, nothing is ever over, particularly when it's pronounced over by one of the principals. So this isn't over. It's not even close to being over. It was wishful thinking from the secretary. This is going to be a controversy that may go as far as the New Hampshire primary and beyond.
It's also good to remember that this is not just a 16-word sentence that's in dispute. This would not be a controversy if there weren't two other facts in play. One is that the administration never claimed there was an imminent threat in Iraq, and two, they haven't found any weapons of mass destruction. And so it creates the impression that this was an intentional effort on the part of the president to mislead the American public.
And as we know, David, perception becomes reality. According to a new Newsweek poll, 45% of Americans say they believe the administration misinterpreted intelligence reports that proved Iraq was hiding chemical or biological weapons before the war. 38% believe that the administration misled the public. So what do you think?
Well, I think that this is going to be debated not only among the public but among the Democratic candidates and later perhaps between the Democratic nominee and President Bush in the presidential debate. This is a very serious matter. When you go before the American people, you're supposed to tell the truth. The president thought he was telling the truth. In some ways, he's really not vulnerable, but the administration is.
Bob Graham, one of the Democratic presidential contenders, was also on the Sunday talk shows, and he said the opposite, though. He said this isn't an issue of George Tenet. This is an issue of George Bush. Conversely, Sarah, can this backfire on the Democrats if, in fact, the weapons of mass destruction are found?
Well, it could if they found a big enough cache of weapons. But credibility, Robin, is the major component of presidential leadership. And this has always been George Bush's strong point, his leadership ability. And so he's in danger of losing the most important part of his presidency.
Yeah, but David, Donald Rumsfeld also said on the morning shows that the public really doesn't care about the ins and outs of this story.
Well, they probably do care. And I think the public opinion polls will show that. But I've always believed that the last people to be able to judge what the public cares about are the people who are in the middle of a dispute. And the second to last people, of course, are us.
Right. And if the public really didn't care, you wouldn't have seen Donald Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice on television everywhere yesterday.
How about their handling of this issue, Sarah? Stay with that for a second, because it seems for an administration that has been on message all along, this was not a very pretty week.
No, they first said we knew it was wrong, and then they said now they're saying, well, it was technically true. They are operating like people who are very much on the defensive, and so it's hard to believe that they really think this is unimportant.
Yeah. And David, I'm thinking too, one of your colleagues, Tom Friedman, has been saying for quite a while, if only the administration had said, we need to do this because this is a mass murderer, they have uncovered the mass graves, whereas they haven't found the weapons of mass destruction.
Right, and you've seen a very subtle shift in the debate in Washington from emphasis from the administration's part on weapons of mass destruction to horrible human rights abuses. I think you'll see more of that because Saddam Hussein is unambiguously guilty of that, if not of assembling weapons of mass destruction.
Mm. Well, as the debate about the 16 words goes on, Donald Rumsfeld also spoke this weekend of troop deployment in Iraq, saying it might go up, a change from his previous statements. He also said that the U.S. military was bracing for more assaults against U.S. forces because of the upcoming anniversaries that are tied to Saddam Hussein. Pretty grim, Sarah.
Yes, and this is why the public is paying attention, because there are a lot of lives involved of American servicemen, either who have been there for a long time or those who will be rotated in. And so that's why this issue connects to the people.
Yeah. And one last thought, David. The Los Angeles Times webpage is reporting about a memo leaked to the paper, a July 9th memo from Donald Rumsfeld to the Secretaries of Air Force, Navy, Army, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in which Rumsfeld outlines a real shift in the military, shifting some of the professional specialties from the reserves to the active duty military, and essentially creating a force that could mobilize for war within 15 days. Your thoughts?
Well, the country has learned that it has to become battle-ready a lot faster, that wars don't start with declarations the way they used to, that the defense of the American homeland requires swiftness and it requires mobility, and I think there isn't anybody in Washington who's going to dispute that.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Well, thank you, and it's great to have Sarah back.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, it is. And we'll see together what the week holds for us. Sarah Fritz is Washington Bureau Chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. David Trimman, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new study on daycare in America. How does it serve our children?
And we speak to diva Linda Eder about her latest CD, Broadway My Way.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, an Oregon doctor who fought for physician-assisted suicide is prepared to live and die by his convictions. He's been diagnosed with terminal cancer.
I am dead already, as far as my life is concerned, and I'm just wanting to take out some of the misery of it.
Also, there are two tenors taking the country by storm. We'll see what Here and Now's classical music connoisseur thinks of their CD, Duetto.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. Iraq's new U.S.-backed governing council on its first full day of business today voted to send a delegation to the United Nations. During an inaugural session yesterday, members set the day Baghdad fell to U.S. forces as a national holiday and banned celebrating several dates that are important to Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party. Meantime, the head of the Arab League is skeptical about the U.S.-backed council. He says it would have had more credibility if its members had been elected. Another hit-and-run attack in Baghdad has left one U.S. soldier dead, six others wounded. Thelma LeBrec has the latest from the Iraqi capital.
The U.S. military says insurgents fired several rocket-propelled grenades at a military convoy in West Baghdad, killing one U.S. soldier and wounding six others. Also, the military says a non-hostile incident in southern Iraq left a Marine dead. This brings to 32 the number of American soldiers killed in hostile actions since President Bush declared an end to major combat in Iraq. The latest violence occurred on Iraq's Revolution Day, and officials here at the Pentagon warn other anniversaries this month may provoke further unrest in Iraq. Thelma LeBrec at the Pentagon.
The nation's oldest and largest civil rights organization opened its annual convention in Miami, criticizing President Bush and his brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, for their efforts to dismantle affirmative action policies. Julian Bond, chairman of the NAACP, speaking at the opening of the 94th annual convention, praised the recent Supreme Court ruling that upheld the use of race as a factor in university admissions policies. Bond also vowed the organization will work to unseat the president in 2004. The nationwide search continues for two missing children authorities fear were killed by their father. 14-year-old Sarah Gehring and her 11-year-old brother Philip were last seen with their father as they left a July 4th fireworks display in Concord, New Hampshire. Manuel Gehring, who's divorced from the kid's mother, was arrested a week later in California. With Tropical Storm Claudette creeping northward, forecasters have posted hurricane warnings for 200 miles of the Texas coast. National Hurricane Center Director Max Mayfield says the storm will reach hurricane strength before it makes landfall. Forecasters expect up to 8 inches of rain and storm surges as high as 5 feet. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 124 points.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The New York Civil Liberties Union has filed suit in Manhattan's federal district court on behalf of a 13- and a 14-year-old girl. The girls were told they couldn't return to Intermediate School 164 in Washington Heights until they were tested to prove they hadn't contracted a sexually transmitted disease and that they weren't pregnant. The girls had played hooky and gone to a midday party, and school officials had apparently gotten wind of debauchery at the party. Still, a boy from the school who attended was not asked to undergo any tests. Well, joining me on the line is Donna Lieberman. She's executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and welcome, Donna.
Thanks.
Donna, on what grounds are you suing?
The school has violated their right to privacy. It's violated their right to go to school as required and provided for under the New York State education law. And it's violated their right to due process. The school has absolutely no right to make school attendance conditional on medical exams that have absolutely nothing to do with the health and well-being of the other students.
But what if the girls had contracted a sexually transmitted disease or become pregnant? Isn't it a good thing for the school to know that?
It's none of the school's business. You know, medical information, when you and I go to the doctor, we count on being able to have that as a confidential relation. And for teenagers, that's also the case. In fact, it's especially the case. You know, young people cite fears about confidentiality as one of the prime reasons that they stay away from health care.
What's the school district's response so far?
The Department of Education undertook basically a self-serving investigation, ignored the opportunities to gather factual evidence that it could have pursued, and just said, oh, it didn't happen that way. Since the filing of the lawsuit, the Department of Education has not commented on the case.
Where were the parents in all this?
They were summoned to school, and appropriately so, I might add, when the school found out. But in talking with the parents about what had happened, the school ordered them to subject their children to these intrusive tests. Many of the families in the school are Dominican, many with limited English, and the parents, like the students, didn't know what their rights were, and so they agreed to do what they had to do.
Donna, what do you make of the fact that the boy from Intermediate School 164, who was allegedly at this raucous party, was not asked to take any tests?
I think it's just an indication that the old stereotypes about boys and girls continue to this day. The girls have been marked with the Scarlet A by virtue of their alleged wrongdoing. I can only say that we're so grateful that the medical community helped these young women and their parents.
Yeah, it was the medical community actually that alerted you to all this.
That's because, you know, they understand the rights of their patients, their medical responsibilities.
So, Donna, what kind of compensation are you looking for as a result of the lawsuit?
Well, they're looking for an apology, for their records to be cleared, and for a declaration that this can never happen again, essentially. But they are also looking for damages. These are low-income families, and they suffered both emotional and concrete damages. You know, people lost work in order to deal with the situation. The point for the New York Civil Liberties Union is to right this wrong, and we want the Department of Education to undertake some very serious training of its staff, top to bottom, to ensure that they understand and respect the rights of young women, young girls in school, and do not exhibit the lack of understanding that gives rise to a situation like this.
Donna Lieberman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Donna Lieberman is executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union.
Since Oregon's law on physician-assisted suicide passed 5 years ago, almost 200 lethal drug doses have been prescribed and 129 taken, four of them by doctors. Well, now a fifth doctor is considering assisted suicide, and he's been one of the most outspoken proponents of physician-assisted suicide. Dr. Allison Willifer joins us on the line from his home in Malala, Oregon. Welcome, doctor.
Good morning.
Well, doctor, how is your health? I mean, I presume not good.
I have cancer of the kidney with metastasis to my lungs, which means it's going to take me.
Well, the law in Oregon says that two doctors have to agree that the patient has 6 months to live. Do you have only 6 months to live?
Yes, and I have the two physicians have already signed my letters. And I've got all the paperwork done.
Yeah. You're someone, as I said, who's been a proponent of physician-assisted suicide. Have you thought of this for a while?
Yes, ma'am. Long time.
What are your thoughts?
Well, before they ever had this law, I wanted to have the option of terminating my life if it got terrible enough. But since this law came in, I certainly want to have the option.
Mm. You know, two phrases are floating up: do no harm and physician, heal thyself. How do your actions jive with those?
I'm doing no harm. I'm going to die very soon, no matter what. I'm going to die soon. And I will be healing myself.
Well, what do you say to those? And I know you've heard from those who say that, you know, this is the opposite of what a doctor in particular should do, that it is harmful to end a life before nature ends it, and that this is not a physician healing himself, but killing himself.
I don't look at it that way, because I am dead already, as far as my life is concerned. And I'm just wanting to take out some of the misery of it. I'm not hurting anyone, and my God and I have this straight. And I would not recommend it to anybody else. It's their own choosing.
Yeah. Are you, it's occurring to me as well that you are more aware of your imminent death than anyone, I presume. Are you diagnosing yourself? What are you seeing? What symptoms are you seeing?
No, I haven't had any real bad symptoms yet. Like I say, the only thing I've really developed most now was more shortness of breath. And my appetite has been cut down to about half in the last 2 weeks. And I'm beginning to have a little pains in my right kidney. And that's the only real symptoms of it.
Yeah. I just wonder if you have any thoughts about the patients that you've assisted in this in the past, and here you are watching it happen in yourself.
I have no regrets or of anyone that I may have helped in their dying, but which all doctors have at some time in their life.
Mm. Well, another part of the law says that this this assisted suicide can't be used if, in fact, the patient is diagnosed as clinically depressed and or being coerced. What do you say to those who say that you are just depressed?
That's not true. Anyone that's going to die, I think, is going to have some depression.
Hmm.
But it's not anything unusual in what I would expect to have.
Well, how does your family feel about this, doctor?
Well, they're not jumping up and down with joy, but they all know about it, and they're not objections at all.
What would you say if a family member or loved one or even a patient of yours said to you, doctor, I don't want to see you do this. I want to see if it lasts longer than you think. I urge you to consider something else. What would you say?
It's not their decision to make. This is a personal decision. I may not do it, but I want the option.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Williford, we wish you well.
Thank you.
And take care.
Thank you.
Dr. Allison Williford, he spoke to us from his home in Malala, Oregon. He is 79 years old.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Members of the Saudi royal family will soon be taking correspondence classes to a new level. Because some college-age members of the family are afraid to fly to the U.S. post-9/11, George Washington University is developing a special distance learning program for 6 family members, and it's raising some eyebrows at the school. Joining us to talk about the new curriculum is William Frawley. He's dean of the Columbian College of Arts and Sciences at George Washington University. Good afternoon, Dean.
Hello.
Well, we understand the Saudi students will be studying online and that some professors may actually travel to them as well.
We've developed a program that combines asynchronous education. That means you can provide a course at one time that is accessed at another time.
Uh-huh.
That combines that and the best of distance education and visits and face-to-face contact. So it's a constellation of factors that would be involved in this.
Well, you know, some people are saying all of this for 6 students. The school's also going to have an administrator in Riyadh. It's like GWU, the Riyadh branch. You know, there's been some question about it. Why did you decide to do it?
Well, I suppose we could talk about what kind of questions have come up, because I haven't heard many.
Well, in fact, in an article that I'm looking at in the Washington Post, some people are questioning, you know, this kind of a output for 6 students in Saudi Arabia when so many foreign students post-9/11 can't even get into the country to get their visas. And it just seems like an awful lot of expense for 6 students.
Well, you know, we were approached by the family to develop a program of this sort, and we thought about it long and hard before we agreed to go ahead with it. We considered 3 factors, you know, does this fit with our mission? And one of our missions is to develop innovative education, especially international education. Can we maintain the standards that we've always maintained? And absolutely, there's nothing out of normal here.
Mm. Well, and some of the other questions are about the country itself. You know, it's a
a country that has limited free speech and human rights. Women, for instance, are not allowed to drive or expose the face. Will female faculty be able to go?
Yes.
And what will they be learning?
They will follow a normal course of study, including general education requirements, the normal advising freshman programs, writing programs. That is, they will have an absolutely normal course of study and a normal major. It's just that we're doing it in a way that meets the other things that we think we do pretty well. So in all ways, this is a program that is exactly like many of the other things we do in other kinds of distance education. You know, we have agreements with the Navy, with delivering education to China and other kinds of places.
Right. This isn't the first distance learning that your school or other schools offer.
I think the university as a whole, you know, the U University, needs to respond to the way the world works in a new way. And if the university is going to see itself as a vibrant, functioning intellectual enterprise that understands that the boundaries between the classroom and the world need to be porous, then we have to do things like this. The University of Louisville has an imaginative program with a UPS to provide a degree completion for UPS at, you know, all times of the day or night. So lots of universities are taking this activity, and I think this way of delivering education is going to be the way of the future.
Did they really not pay you any more than other students?
We don't discuss financial arrangements about this or about anybody.
Well, good luck with it.
We're looking forward to it. We think it'll be a model, and we're very excited about doing things in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
William Frawley is the dean of George Washington University's Columbian College of Arts and Sciences. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
First, there were the three tenors, Luciano Pavarotti, Placido Domingo, and Jose Carreras, arguably the most popular male vocalists in opera. That's Pavarotti, Domingo, and Carreras performing O Sole Mio from their best-selling CD, The Three Tenors in Concert. Well, now, the record label Sony Classics is marketing tenors of its own, Marcelo Alvarez and Salvatore Lecitra, and Sony Classics is calling them the heirs to the three tenors. The CD is called Duetto, and this summer there have been TV appearances, a video, and live concerts by the two tenors. So we've asked Ellen Pfeiffer, Here and Now's classical music reviewer, to serenade us with her thoughts on the two new tenors and the high pitch of hype around them. Welcome, Ellen.
Hi, Bill.
So, Ellen, I want to ask you first about the two tenors. Are they the real deal or just jumping on the tenor bandwagon?
Well, they are the real deal, but I'm afraid you're not going to hear much of that on this new recording.
Uh-huh.
You can hear them together, but you can't hear them separately because they're singing almost entirely together, and when they are singing by themselves, they're not identified. So if you don't know what they sound like, you don't know who's singing.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little disconcerting.
Cuando la mujer te da su amor a ti, vas a sentir que estará en cielo.
Why don't we separate them out for our audience for now anyway and introduce each one of them. First, Marcelo Alvarez.
He's an Argentinian tenor. He's 41. He is a fairly newcomer to the classical music world. He studied voice as a child, but then went into the family furniture business. And it was only when he turned 30 that he decided, at his wife's urging, to pursue the vocal studies. He made his Met debut in 1998 and has been singing around many of the major opera houses throughout the world. And he has a very light lyric tenor. It's very elegant. And I think you'll hear that on this recording of Alfredo's arias from La Traviata.
Ella tempra col placido sorriso dell'amor, tale di che di sé vivere io voglio te fedele, quell'universo in me.
Elegant Argentinian Marcelo Alvarez. The other of the two new tenors, Salvatore Licitra.
Well, he's an Italian, and he too came somewhat late to singing. He was 18 or 19 years old. He was on vacation in Sicily and was singing along with some music on the radio, and his mother overheard him and yelled in from the garden, "Who is this madman?" And then realized it was her son.
Wow.
And said, "Well, you know, maybe you should take some singing lessons."
How interesting that they both came so late to their gift.
So he did. And his biggest fame so far has been, he's only 34. His biggest fame has been that he filled in for Pavarotti last May, a year ago May, at the Metropolitan Opera when Pavarotti was supposedly making his farewell appearances. And people had paid $1,800 for their tickets, and he canceled because he was ill. And Licitra filled in rather creditably. Now, he's a different kind of a singer. It's a heavier voice, more baritonal in quality. Has a little bit of an edge to it. It's not quite as elegant as Alvarez.
Già troppa era un'offesa, doppia vendetta, hai sul tuo capo accesa.
Wow.
Yes.
Kind of fierce.
It certainly is.
How do they stack up against someone like Pavarotti?
Well, I think Pavarotti was a more refined singer than Licitra as a young man. And we have an example here of one aria sung by both of them from Il Trovatore di Quella Pira. And it's pretty clear when you hear this how careful and fastidious Pavarotti was about making the embellishments very clear and elegant. And Licitra kind of steamrolls them. So first, here's Pavarotti.
E mi spegnerò, odio fra poco, col sangue nero la spegnerò.
And now Licitra.
Yeah, you can hear a difference there. I'm no expert, but Licitra doesn't seem to have a certain magic that Pavarotti does.
Well, it's exciting, but it's a little crude.
Yeah. Well, what about this CD duetto? Is it exciting enough for you? What did you think of it?
It's a very goopy, very commercial.
Goopy. Is that like schlocky?
Schlocky, commercial. Mm. All the pieces are new. They commissioned songs by some of the composers that have been associated with Andrea Bocelli. And the lyrics are really dumb, moon, June, that kind of thing. Mm. And what's really kind of annoying is that some of them have taken classic tenor arias or duets and kind of mixed them in with their own stuff. There's a duet from the Pearlfishers, originally for tenor and baritone, that they've made for two tenors. And there's an aria that they've made it into a duet. And then this piece is mixed with Faust's Salut de Mur Chasse de Pur from Faust by Gounod. And it's been bowdlerized, I guess you'd say.
Nel cuore mio ti porterò per sempre.
Despite what I might think about the CD, these guys are really hot, and they're going to be hotter. They've got this new CD. There's a video coming out. The live performances that they did in Rome were taped for Great Performances and are going to be broadcast all over PBS this summer. And on the 19th of July, they're performing at New York's Central Park as part of the 150th anniversary celebrations for Central Park. Those performances, I think you get a chance to actually hear them sing solo as well as duets. So that might be a little more useful and entertaining and gratifying for music lovers.
Well, you've certainly heard, if you're a classic music lover, of the three tenors, now the two tenors. And I want to thank you, Ellen, for giving us your take on it all.
Thanks.
Here and Now's classical music connoisseur, Ellen Pfeiffer. For more information on the two tenors, Marcelo Alvarez and Salvatore Licitra, check out our website at here-now.org.
Una scia di luce restò davanti al mare, e chi puoi capitare?
I kind of like them. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Goopiness is not all bad. Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Stefano Katsonis, Lindsay Crudell, Jordana Gustafson, Emiko Tomogawa, and Andy Meyer. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Allison Vence.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at computing software. Information on the web at